Thank you, Mr. Spellman, and good morning, everyone, with my impromptu news analysis. No, I did bring some bits and pieces with me, just in case. It's just as well we managed to do that. So there's been a little bit going on. I've made various comments about the Europe, certainly, in the past, and about what's going regarding the British being blamed for so many things, and yet the French and the Dutch actually voting down the constitution. But before I go and have a look at some of those, another couple of clippings that from this past week on that subject. There is one that was in the Telegraph. This is dated, let's have a look. It's the Monday, June the 13th, so this previous Monday. And it says, the settlers of Homesh prepare for the last stand. Says the planned closure of the Israeli settlements of the Palestine land entered its potential bloody endgame yesterday after Israel's High Court issued a somber statement, turning down the final legal challenge to the withdrawal. These are difficult days. The nation is divided and fears of violence hang in the air, its judges said, shifting the focus of the opposition movement from the law courts to the settlements themselves. It's a challenge that scores of many young religious settler zealots are willing to accept in Homesh, a natural fortress on top of a hill in the northwestern West Bank. So, you know, it is. It does look as if there's going to be some trouble in that particular area. They've got to clear this area. And I know that many of the Israeli army, from what I understand, they're not going to go ahead and do it because, you know, they're not going to go ahead and use their weapons against or their equipment or whatever they're in fact being commanded to do against their own people, and therefore there is a problem for the government there. But you know, there's other things as well going on. There was a statement. Now there's a Sanhedrin apparently over in Jerusalem, and this Sanhedrin, it says the Sanhedrin calls upon all groups who work in the area of the temple and the Temple Mount related research and activity to begin to prepare detailed architectural plans for the construction of the Holy Temple. Now this is what the Sanhedrin have apparently come out with. Now who exactly the Sanhedrin are? They're obviously a group of rabbis of some description, but how they were appointed and how much actual clout in the Israeli religious circles they have, I'm not sure. But it is interesting because I went and looked on the Temple Institute website where this came from, which and get a little bit more information about them. Toward the goal of the establishment of its proper place, the Sanhedrin will establish a forum of architects and engineers whose goal will be to implement this decision so that detailed working plans are effectively brought to an operational stage. The Sanhedrin calls upon the Jewish people to contribute towards the acquisition of materials and the purpose of rebuilding the Holy Temple, the gathering and preparation of prefabricated, disassembled portions of this building. Now with the modern building techniques and with the cranes and everything else that they've got, you can imagine that they could quite easily put a prefabricated temple together. And that is something that, you know, the techniques in prefabrication are something that have advanced a great deal over the last few years. And concrete prefabrication and with marble or whatever else as the cladding material could quite easily be done. He says, disassemble portions of this building to be stored and ready for rapid assembly in the manner of King David. In other words, they were prepared off-site, they're brought in, and they're assembled. Now you wonder, why were they done that? Why was it done that way? It said so that not a noise of a hammer would be heard. But looking down the line, could it be that that also gives an impetus to what we are seeing is currently developing? Now I'm not saying there's going to be a temple down in Jerusalem, I'm not saying that at all. But they're going in that direction. This is the point. And by going in that direction, then it starts to inflame the area. And there's a few other things I'd like to read a little bit. It says, these contributions would be considered chulin or kulin, i.e. non-sacred for the purpose of planning and constructing the temple. So this is from Professor Hiller Weiss and Rabbi Karim Richman, the spokesman of the Sanhedrin. As I say, I don't know how much clout they have religiously. I would imagine that the Sanhedrin is composed of priests. In other words, they've gone into the lineage. They're and they are the, I think there's 70 in the Sanhedrin, as I understand it. It goes into, you know, there's an article here about the Temple Institute, but it's interesting that in reading through this, there's an awful lot of work that's already been done. There are most of the vessels and all the equipment, the ephod has been made, the breastplate, the gems in the breastplate, where the Urim and Thummim are kept, all of that has been done. The various bowls and things for sacrifices have been made. The other thing which I found very, very interesting, and this is coming from, let's see, where was this? This again is coming out of this same, let's look, where's the source of this? I think it's from the same source. But there's an individual. Those of you that have actually seen Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, we all kind of smile at this and think, oh, well, you know, Indiana Jones, totally fictitious, nothing to do with anything to do with reality. Apparently, that's not quite true. The person who wrote the script for Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark was on an archaeological dig down in Jerusalem, in the area of Israel. And there is an individual who was the head of this particular dig that he was on. Let's see, what's his name, this man who wrote the Indiana Jones trilogy? There's a book, I can't immediately go to it. But there is a leader of that particular dig is called Vendil, V-E-N-D-Y-L, Jones. Now all you have to do is cross off the V and cross off the L, and you've got Indy, Indiana Jones. And that's who it was actually based on. Now what this particular individual is an archaeologist, Vendil Jones, who has basically devoted his life to discovering where the Ark is. And he's made an announcement. It says an unnamed Kabbalist has an unnamed Kabbalah. You know, Kabbalah is the mysticism of Judaism. It's part of the kind of Gnosticism, and it's what you find in Colossians being decried and various places in scripture. But an unnamed Kabbalist has granted a blessing to the famed archaeologist Dr. Vendil Jones to uncover the Holy Ark of the Covenant. Jones plans to excavate the Lost Ark by Tishri, by the fast, in other words, by this coming atonement. Now, if that were to be the case, if he actually has discovered the location, and he says, the famed archaeologist who is the inspiration of Indiana Jones series has spent most of his life searching for the Ark, and they've discovered that there are tunnels underneath the Temple Mount, and I can personally verify that. In fact, I pushed Judy through one particular time, but it actually went under the area around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and was an aqueduct that ran under the Temple Mount, and we went as far as we could within this aqueduct, and there was a rock fall, and we wanted to excavate through that rock fall, and we were not allowed to, because it was too politically sensitive to have the Muslims bowing and doing all the bits and pieces above, so that we weren't allowed to excavate. But they have gone ahead and they have excavated some of these tunnels, and they've also, presumably using seismology, they've traced some of them, and some of them, they don't just stay within Temple Mount, but they go off across by the Mount of Olives, out into the Judean wilderness for several miles. And it's in one of those tunnels that they think the Ark of the Covenant has been stored. And he feels that by looking at the various rock formations above them and what's been placed in certain positions, he feels that he knows where this particular location is. And what he wants to do is to drop a camera, one of these miniature cameras, down a small telescopic borehole, and have a look and see whether in fact it's there. Now, if that were the case, I'm just saying there's an awful lot of ifs, but if it were the case, it would inflame the area. And we do need to be aware that it doesn't have to be that there's a temple built. Mr. Armstrong said, you know, the chances of a temple being built is virtually, you know, it's so remote because it would cause so much trouble. But it's the direction in which they're going. And this Temple Institute is absolutely, their entire function is to build this temple, is to get ready. And when they start to build, they will start to sacrifice. They will be doing the evening and morning sacrifice. And from that, when the sacrifice comes to an end, then there's 1,260 days. So 290 days, sorry. If we have a look at Isaiah 9, go over in Isaiah chapter 9. You know, these things, although they don't hit the headlines, they are so significant prophetically. Because in Isaiah 9, at the end of Isaiah 9, there is an indication that there's going to be real problems at the end time, before Israel goes into captivity, before Assyria rises and the beast power. And it's not just Assyria. It's the Assyrian-led beast power, the Holy Roman Empire. It is going back into medieval times. It's not just going back into what we saw with Hitler. It goes further back than that, many, you know, 1,000 years further back than that. But here in Isaiah 9, it says, verse 18, "For wickedness burns as a fire," in verse 18. "It'll devour the briars and thorns and shall kindle in the thickets of the forest, and they'll mount up like the lifting up of smoke. Through the wrath of the Eternal of Hosts is the land darkened, and the people shall be as the fuel of the fire, and no man shall spare his brother." There's going to be controversy, and there's going to be factions within Israel and Judah. "And he shall snatch on the right hand and be hungry, and he'll eat on the left hand, and they will not be satisfied. They will eat every man the flesh of his own arm." They'll be fighting among themselves by the indication of what it's saying here. It says Manasseh, Ephraim, Ephraim, Manasseh. There could be controversy between the two countries. Now I say could, because the real controversy is between Israel and the beast power. That's the major controversy, but it may not be visible. It may be under the surface. We don't know. But it does say here, "And they together," so Ephraim and Manasseh together, "are going to be against Judah," to be against Judah. And for all this, his anger isn't turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. He is going to get punished further by using the Assyrian, as it goes into the next chapter, in chapter 10, "Assyria, the rod of my anger," and so on. So we're looking at a position of Judah right at the end time that gives, it's going to cause some problems. Whatever it is, it's going to cause factions between Ephraim and Manasseh and Judah, and there's going to be there'll be a polarization. Now, Israel, the country of Israel, in other words, Judah today, cannot survive without American help. It is surrounded by enemies all the way around it. And if Israel, you know, if it goes across into a religious body that is in control, if this Sanhedrin is more than just a something that somebody happens to set up, it is more to it than that. And they start animal sacrifice. I mean, you imagine in Britain, you start animal sacrifices somewhere, and it goes on television, you'd have an absolute total uprising, absolute uprising. You know, you can kill as many people as you like, but you touch an animal. Something different, you know, in a visible way. So I'm being slightly facetious there, but it is true. It is true that we do have an awful lot of feelings for animals, which really is rather ridiculous in many cases. And at the same time, we see Europe in chaos today. In this past week, we've had a headline, and this is coming from last Tuesday. And again, I've only got, I don't even know, we didn't get Wednesdays, did we? No, we didn't get Wednesdays, so we only had Monday and Tuesday's papers, unfortunately. But and last Tuesday's, it's got right in the front paper, the front page of the Telegraph. It says, "France finally buries the EU treaty." It says, "France performed a historic about-turn yesterday and abandoned the European Union constitution to its fate, dropping demands that other nations ratify the treaty. So here's one of the main proponents of the treaty, where in fact they've gone ahead and they've abandoned it. The unexpected move appeared to seal the constitution's doom, even as its most passionate supporters still refuse to accept its demise for several months more. Days before a crucial EU summit, it goes in about the French foreign minister and so on. there. At the same time, however, because of the nature of a beast, in that sense, if you pardon the pun, Britain, inside the same paper, it says Britain is branded a black sheep of the EU. So there's an alienation. Britain is moving away from the EU, and Britain is not going to be part of this European beast power when it comes up. And this alienation that's occurring at the moment is, again, prophetic. It says France raises the stakes and accuses the UK of ducking the enlargement bill. It says France yesterday launched a campaign to cast Britain as the black sheep of Europe, declaring that if Tony Blair did not abandon its £3 billion a year rebate, he would block all hopes of a deal on a new European Union budget. In other words, they're blaming Britain for the problems. Now, the fact is that the reason why Britain won't do that is because of the agricultural policy that's there, because it is leaning so far in France's favour. It's beyond belief. In fact, I don't know what the actual figures are, but I believe the figures that go in France's favour are so much greater than this £3 million rebate that Britain gets. But this is the reason why they will not go ahead and do that until there's some really major constitutional reforms. If we turn over to Hosea, let's have a look at Hosea chapter 8. Hosea chapter 8. Because, you know, you've got various quotes. It says here, this is from Jacques Chirac. It says, "The time has come for our British friends to understand that today we need a gesture of solidarity towards Europe." Mr. Blair said, "Britain has been making a gesture because over the last 10 years we have been making a contribution to Europe 2.5 times that of France." So we were paying into Europe twice, 2.5 times what France is paying into Europe. With that rebate, you know, having, you know, taking the rebate into account, we're still paying 2.5 times more. And Mr. Blair said, what you can't have is to take one part of this debate and say it's all about the British rebate. And Jacques Chirac says, it's a question that I'm not prepared to revisit regarding farming subsidies. So there's total stalemate, the head-to-head, there's total stalemate there. And what is being, what they're trying to get is for Britain to give up the rebate that is there, which tends to give the balance to some degree. And if here in Hosea chapter 8, if we notice in verse 9, it says, "They're gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone, by himself. Ephraim has hired lovers." And we indeed have hired lovers. Yes, though they have hired among the nations, now I will gather them, and they will sorrow a little for the burden of the king of princes. In other words, they are going to go and have problems that they are going to sorrow through the tribulation. If we go back to Hosea chapter 2, the second chapter of Hosea, it says here in verse 4, it says, "And I will not have mercy upon her children, for they are the children of whoredoms." And in verse 5 it says, "For their mother has played the harlot. She's conceived them. She that conceived them has done shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers that give me my bread and my water, my wool, my flax, my oil, my drink." And we look upon Europe as providing all these good things for Britain. And in fact, that's not the case. Britain was blessed because of the promises of faithful Abraham. It's the promises of God. It says, "Therefore, behold, I will hedge up your way with thorns. I'll make a wall, and you will not find your paths. And she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. And she, though she shall seek them, she will not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then it was better with me than now." Eventually, Britain and Ephraim, your Canada as well, will in fact repent and will in fact turn and will return to God. "For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal, the Lord." They served a false god. They looked at a false god, a Trinitarian god. "Therefore I will return and take away my corn to the time, thereof, and the wine in the season thereof. And I will recover my wool, and my flax given to cover her nakedness. And now I will discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of my hand. And within Europe, every single nation is against this idea of Britain having a rebate, because they're getting something, obviously, that everybody else would like as well. But Mrs. Thatcher negotiated that to counterbalance the common agricultural policy. I will also cause all her mirth to cease, and her feast days and her new moons and so on. I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, and when she said, these are my rewards that my lovers have given me. And you know, all the vines, all the wine, all the fig trees, everything else that's flowing into Europe, from Europe. And I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall eat them. And I will visit upon her the days of Baalim, when she burned incense to them, and has decked herself with her earrings and her jewels. So God is not mocked, and certainly what we're looking at within the European theatre is a continuation of the prophecies and a continuation of the way in which Ephraim in fact is going and will go. And also when we're looking at the other part of the house of Judah and what is happening in the house of Judah, prophetically things are moving, things are happening. And we need to watch and be aware of these things, and need to be aware that our days of being prepared and our days of becoming ready to be teachers in the future, they are being numbered. They're not going to go on forever. And every single one of us within the church has got to be aware of that.